Welcome to the Imagine Israel podcast, brought to you by the Jewish Federation of Greater Washington. Imagine Israel is the initiative of the Jewish Federation of Greater Washington, connecting Washingtonians to Israel and Israelis through the lens of social change. With every Imagine Israel podcast, we get to meet innovative Israeli influencers and changemakers, people addressing social and economic challenges in Israel. We'll hear from people whose lives and whose work intersect as they address issues in Israeli society. And I'm your host, Robbie Grindgrass, and I'm coming to you from Makom, the Israel Education Lab of the Jewish Agency for Israel. In this episode of Imagine Israel, we decided to take a closer look at the situation of African asylum seekers in Israel. It's actually already kind of political that I used that descriptor, asylum seekers. Because these people who mostly arrived in Israel over the last 10 years from war-torn Sudan and dictatorial Eritrea get described in Israel with very different terms. Each of these terms contain truth and bias. Some will call them economic migrants, others call them refugees, others brand them infiltrators, and others asylum seekers. And however you describe them, Israel's government has recently decided that some 60,000 of these folks must now leave the country because they can't return to the danger of Eritrea or to Sudan. A third country, probably Rwanda, is due to receive them. Now, this move has led to loud protests from the Jewish community around the world and from certain areas of Israeli society. And one person leading these cries in Israel is Patrick Levy. Patrick would describe himself as a Zionist who, as we'll hear, embodies his hope for Israel through non-stop, unsought-for protest and activism against Israeli governmental decisions. And recently, the fate of the African asylum seekers, in particular those living with AIDS, has demanded his attention once more. I popped over to his house in the Galilee to hear more about his work, his calling, and his story. So, Patrick Levy.
Hello, hi.
Hi there. So I popped into your Facebook page.
Okay.
And I saw that you had posted the same thing in four different languages.
Mm-hmm.
It was in English, it was in Hebrew, it was in Spanish, it was in French. What was so important for you to not trust Facebook Translate?
Well, what's happening right now with migrants from Africa, asylum seekers, is something that I've been involved in for the last 5 years. And representing a foundation, an American foundation, which is called HATD, Healing Across the Divides. It's an organization which is supporting projects on community health, mm-hmm. both in Israel and in the West Bank. I'm their representative here in Israel. And obviously one of the main vulnerable populations that we are supporting is asylum seekers through a project from ASAF, which is the main organization dealing with asylum seekers, and the Israeli AIDS Task Force on prevention of HIV, but also on support of people living with HIV.
Well, hang on. So there's a whole conglomeration of stuff.
Yeah.
So first of all, why, I know this sounds like a dumb question, why are asylum seekers vulnerable? Surely if they're asylum seekers, they've applied for asylum, they've been given rights by the government, they have jobs. Presumably, why on earth would they be vulnerable?
Well, the reality in Israel is slightly different. Since 2007, we had amongst 35,000 migrants who came through Egypt to Israel.
So they left Sudan or Eritrea.
They left Sudan and Eritrea,
north,
walked,
went through
Sinai.
Wow.
On the way, rape and
murder.
And violence and murders and everything. And then
why didn't they stay in Egypt?
They didn't stay in Egypt because they were not safe there, because the Egyptian government didn't want them.
Uh-huh.
Because some of them actually were killed for organs, and wow. Others moved to be slaves in African country. So the safest country around was Israel. So they came here.
Fascinating.
They reached Tel Aviv mostly because the government wanted them to be in the south part of Tel Aviv with a lot of
Israel. Hang on a second. Yeah. They came through Sinai into Israel. And what, did they just keep walking? Because Sinai to Tel Aviv is a...
It's a long
way. It's like a 5-6 hour drive. True. So how did they get to Tel Aviv?
Well, many of them were taken by the police or by the army at the border and drove them to the south of Tel Aviv and just led them there.
Was that helpful or unhelpful? Would it have been better for them to leave them in the south?
Well,
why did they drive them to Tel Aviv?
Well, South Tel Aviv is one of the areas in Israel where there is a concentration of very unfavorized populations, Israelis, Palestinians, and foreigners. And it's much easier for the police to have an eye on them when they are living together than when they are all over the country. Gotcha. So most of the migrants who came from Africa were put in this place. A few years later, there is a camp which was built by Israel, which is in Holot, in the border with Egypt.
So that is down south.
Yeah, and they took most of the leaders, the male leaders, to this camp. It was not a closed camp, meaning they could have gone outside of the camp, but they needed to be back by the evening when they were checking the names of the people who were inside of the camp. And because the camp is still...
So it's a bit like, you know, a summer camp in America. It's just a day camp. Or just a night camp, actually.
It's actually a sort of...
Have you been there?
I've been there, yeah.
What did it look like?
It's a prison, basically. It's an open prison. It's an open prison because it's open because it's in the middle of the desert and they can go around, but they don't have anything where to go to. So they are not going out so easily. Uh-huh. And because of this checking their names in the morning and in the evenings, they had to stay around. And this was...
And are the living conditions difficult there? Or
prison? So...
Were they locked in?
They were not locked in, apart from the nights.
Oh, in the nights they are locked in?
But they definitely were... They couldn't work, they couldn't earn any money, they couldn't... They had a sort of very basic medical support and food. And then they were released, some of them at least, after a while, after a few months, and said that they could go back somewhere in Israel, but not... Then there was a new decision of the government saying that they could not stay between Gedera and Hadera.
Uh-huh. Basically avoid the center of Israel where Tel Aviv is.
Where they can get work, basically.
Isn't it interesting? Because whenever I've spent time in Tel Aviv, in particular, let's say on a Sunday, wandering around South Tel Aviv, it doesn't look like many of these migrants have left. It feels like it's... On a Sunday, it's the most, I mean, presumably depending on your perspective, but it's a beautiful thing to watch. Everybody's going off to church. They're dressed up really nicely. It's a little Africa in Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
Was the Israeli government also responding to the way in which local South Tel Aviv people received or whether they liked the idea that suddenly they were living in little Africa?
Well, that's the thing. I think that both the government and the municipality of Tel Aviv didn't do a lot to try to help both the Israeli and the ancient residents of Tel Aviv and the new comers from Africa. So it created even a bigger tension between them. You have to understand that it's like a melting pot of Palestinians who are illegally in Tel Aviv, elderly people who have a very low income, and Africans who officially cannot work, but they are doing a lot of work for a very small amount of money in order to just to survive. Now, when I'm saying that there are some of them, 15,000 of them, are asylum seekers, it's not completely true. 50,000 of them asked to get the visa of asylum seekers in Israel. And since 2007
uh-huh.
until now, only 11 got a visa.
How many applied?
Until now, 8,000. So half of the illegal of the asylum seekers.
So 8,000 applied for asylum.
Yeah.
And again, how many received it?
11.
11.
And all the rest are now illegal migrants because they cannot ask again for a visa of asylum seeker.
Once your asylum is turned down, that's it.
Yeah. Let's say that the Israeli government is not exactly into receiving asylum seekers. Now, when you are illegal here, it means that you don't have any health coverage. You can get to the hospital only when there is an emergency.
Uh-huh.
But as soon as you are out of danger, of life danger, then you are on your own. No visa to work, so everything will be completely illegal, obviously with no insurance, as nothing.
So no insurance,
yeah.
Little work,
yeah.
No health coverage.
No. The only one for whom it's slightly different are the children who were born here in Israel.
Uh-huh.
They do have the right to get in schools.
Yes, I mean, I'd recommend to everybody who's listening, if you haven't seen the film Strangers No More, I'd really recommend it, which is in a school called Bialik Rogozin, which is in South Tel Aviv, where these kids of migrants are being educated.
Yeah. In these schools are more than 40 different countries represented.
That's incredible.
In this school, yeah.
So what's changed?
Well,
as in, because the situation sounds like it's been so rosy up until now.
Yeah. So, yes. So the decision of the government decided a few months ago to deport all African migrants to a third country in Africa. And there was meant to be a sort of arrangement between Israel and this country.
As in not to return them from where they've come because it's dangerous,
yeah.
But to somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. And
which often happens, doesn't it? Like in Europe, many migrants arrived in Europe and they've been sent to Turkey.
Or they are stuck in Turkey.
Uh-huh.
Actually, mostly. And then it has been discovered that this third country is Rwanda,
mm-hmm.
which is definitely not the safest place for African non-Rwandese people.
If you're not a Rwandan.
Yeah, it's not exactly the place that you want to go to. And it has been also discovered that the government is paying $5,000 a head to the Rwandese government so that Rwanda will be hosting these people. So it's a sort of market. It's a sort of actually arrangement, contract between
like
Israel
a foster
and Rwanda.
Home.
I'm not sure I would like to get into such a home. And
not sure you'd like to be fostered by Rwanda.
Yeah. And the issue is that people who are now there are now letters which are sent to thousands of people, beginning with the men, and they have 60 days to choose, into brackets, between moving to Rwanda or going to jail in Israel for an unlimited period of time, meaning until they change their mind and they want to go to Rwanda.
Wow.
And that's something which...
But this is only the males, right?
Right now, it's beginning with the male. But seems that it's going to be for the entire community. And within this community, the men, there are subgroups for whom we know that if they will be sent to Rwanda, they will be sent to death. What happened is that the foundation I'm working with, Healing Across the Divides, we are supporting in general populations which are unfavorized in Israel. And amongst them, we supported ASAF, which is the main organization dealing with asylum, and the Israel AIDS Task Force regarding asylum seekers with HIV. The fact is that it seems that there are around 500 asylum seekers with HIV. When this crisis began, and we knew that all the asylum seekers are going to Rwanda, we understood that for people with HIV, it's actually a sort of death sentence, because we succeeded through the Israeli Task Force and ASAF to get them HIV cocktail, the treatments.
So in Israel, they were getting treated?
Yeah. It took us 2 years to sort of force the government, and eventually the government accepted to give treatment to up to 100 and then to 200 people living with HIV. And we know from what's happening in Rwanda that in case they will be moving to Rwanda because they are not citizens, they will not get access to any treatment. And regarding HIV, as soon as you stop to receive the treatments, it boosts the virus and eventually leads to the death of the people that the cocktail is stopped.
And this is also affecting other people with health issues? Who
So people with chronic diseases, people with disabilities. In case they will be moving to Rwanda, they will get zero treatment and they will probably die. It's also the same thing.
Will probably die?
They will probably die because the government of Rwanda is not accepting to give them any treatment. Right. And because they are in need of specific services, speaking about, you know, deaf people and blind people and people on wheelchair.
There's general welfare.
Yeah, and the people with disabilities very often became disabled when they went through Sinai and through torture or organ market, when they were forced to give organs or rape or whatever. And the other population that we do fear that they will face death or at least prison when they will go back to Rwanda and then from there back to their home countries are the gay community. Because in Africa, in most of the countries, being gay is not something that is accepted.
Right, right.
And actually...
And moving from something like LGBT paradise in Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
And going to a place where it's illegal.
Yeah, exactly. And also very often they flew Africa because of that. Because in Eritrea and in Sudan...
They fled Africa because of...
So for them, going to Rwanda... We have to understand that Rwanda is only a station or to go back to their home countries, or that they will be actually fleeing to Libya.
Yeah, it's either a halfway house or it's a place they're going to run from anyway.
Exactly. And if they are going to Libya en route to Europe,
that's fraught with danger.
Yeah, exactly. So, but we do hope that with the work that we are going to do with asylum seekers with HIV, it's going to influence the government to stop also sending people with a high possibility that they will be dying or injured when they will be back to Rwanda. So we do hope that it's going to actually influence.
I guess it's insisting on the legitimate definition of what a refugee is, that they are in danger of their life if they leave here. Yeah. That's
even
the nature of refugee. And how did you end up falling into this?
Well, there is a say maybe that, aniyei icha kodmim, meaning you have to take care of your own poor people. I, as a migrant from France, and my family having been...
Refugees themselves. Like many Jews in Europe.
Yeah, or perished in a concentration camp, or... moving to the US or moving to the south of France, I feel that because of my history, I've got a responsibility also for these people. And also because of the fact that I'm living with HIV for the last 30 years, I've seen stigma and how stigma can kill on myself and also on friends, or at least people can injure and want to put an X on you and not deal with you and with where you are. And also as a gay person, it's just something that, it's not an analysis, it's really something which is coming from my personal story. And also as a human being, I believe if we, all of us, like if all of us, we are speaking about this global village that we are living in, we cannot, define it only when it pleases us. I believe that we have a responsibility. Yeah, so I will go on, and I'm not the only one. There are in Israel not enough, but there are families, including Holocaust survivors, who registered to hide asylum seekers in Israel so that they won't be, they won't need to go back to Rwanda. And there are petitions of physicians and lawyers, but it doesn't seem that the government cares so much until now. And unfortunately, the vast majority of Jews in Israel is in favor of letting the Africans going back to Africa.
But I suppose in one sense, something has moved forward in that over the last 30 years, living with AIDS or living with HIV, at least that has now shifted to being an illness that needs to be treated and not an evil.
Well, it really depends where you live or where you were born. 80% of the people living with HIV in the world are living in countries where it's still a stigma and it's still a death sentence because they don't have access to drugs. And even in Israel, we do have access to drugs, not because of the government, but because of the fight that we had in order to get these drugs.
Can you tell me about the fight that we had?
Yeah.
What, you were a fighter?
I was...
Because you look like a kind of calm kind of guy.
Most of the time. In 96, we began to hear about the cocktails, the HIV cocktails. And it began to be distributed also here in Israel.
Effectively beginning to shift the understanding that AIDS was chronic and not fatal.
Yeah, almost a chronic disease, that you could live with AIDS for tens of years, at least. And a year later, the government, which was Netanyahu's first government, actually, and specifically the Ministry of Health, which that the head of it was a rabbi from Shas, Ben Isri, decided to stop to give the drugs because it was too expensive.
And we need to point out that the health system in Israel are somewhat different from the health system in the United States. There is, one might say, coverage for everybody in the country, and that there is a basket of drugs which are decided on every year according to a particular budget, what gets provided without people having to pay for those drugs.
Exactly. But there is a competition, if I may say, between the diseases.
Oy.
Meaning when one disease enters the basket of drug, sometimes another disease is going out because the basket, the money is not...
It's not endless.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what it must be like to be on that committee.
It's on the committee and also more for the people who are...
Waiting for the results.
And waiting for to see if their medicine will get into the basket of drugs. So
Benjamin Netanyahu, the first time Prime Minister
Prime
of Israel.
Minister, yeah. And
a Shas rabbi in charge
Ministry of Health, who decided to stop the drugs, the HIV drugs, because they were too expensive. So what we saw is people who could not get access to the HIV drugs anymore and began really to agonize because the virus was boosted suddenly.
And when you stop taking the cocktails, then the virus goes crazy.
Yeah. And
it's like finally the cat's out of the house. And
exactly. We didn't have any choice but to fight because we knew that no one will do it instead of us.
You're fighting for your lives.
Yeah, and it was really exactly. So we began to do demonstrations and petitions. I was on debate with the Minister of Health and with Ben Isri, and I asked
on TV.
Yeah, on TV, and I asked him.
You're a TV star.
I was. What we called the face of AIDS at one point, like because there were no my 2 years before my partner and myself, we decided to go out with the fact that we were HIV positive. After I was treated in Yechilov Hospital, the main hospital in Tel Aviv, and with a lot of discrimination around that.
What do you mean discrimination?
Well, my food was put on a table with wheels and
a trolley.
On a trolley and thrown from the corridor to the bed because no one wanted to get into the room.
Oh.
and my IV needed to be changed, but and no one came, so it exploded, my veins exploded, and my bed became red, and AIDS was written on the bed. And I understood that living with HIV is really a sort of double death. It's a physical death, but it's very often before a social death, because mm-hmm. people, including nurses and doctors, will prefer to put you aside and not to deal with you. So when
the social death leads to the medical.
Exactly. So when I went out of the hospital with my partner, we decided to go out with the fact that we were HIV positive, because in Israel we didn't speak about that. And it was important for us to pass on the message that we are citizens of Israel. Mm-hmm. Yes, we are living with HIV, but we want to get the same treatment as anyone else, the same rights, but also the same obligations. I was in a school, I was a teacher, so it made quite a lot of noise when we went right. on.
And so did you carry on as a teacher during
At the end of the school year, I was actually asked by the Ministry of Education to step out of the school uh-huh. because I didn't want to go again through the same debate with the parents.
They asked you to save them hassle.
Exactly. So I stepped out, but I became the first director of the Israel AIDS Task Force. Uh-huh. And then the UN asked me to be the spokesperson for people with HIV from a developed country in Geneva. So
So at least you got a trip to Switzerland.
Yes, many trips to Switzerland, yes. Yes. It was a very challenging period because there was a mass of people living with HIV in Israel. And then when the government decided to stop the HIV...
All of a sudden they don't even have the drugs.
Yeah. So we knew that we had to react if we didn't want to die. And so eventually what happened is that we went into the Court of Justice and we sued the government for not giving us the right to live, basically.
Jesus.
And after a couple of months, the Court of Justice decided to force the government to give all the HIV drugs to all the citizens of Israel living with HIV free of charge, which was a huge victory.
That's massive. As in it's sort of outside of the bucket of drugs?
Yes, yeah. It was a huge victory, but it was a very sad one because we never could imagine that we'll have to sue our government just to live. And also because most of the people who came back to the drugs, to the HIV drugs, the drugs didn't help anymore because the virus was much stronger. And that's what happened to my partner who passed away 2 years after that. I sense that if this decision of the Ministry of Health would not have happened, Ricardo, my partner, would have still be living with me right now. So for me, it's quite sure that his death is actually caused by the ministry and by the government. But, you know, it's not going to bring him back, so...
That's an incredibly tough thing to... So, a government decision killed...
Yeah, I'm not ashamed and not
embarrassed
afraid
to
say that Ricardo was killed by the government. That's definitely something that I believe happened. He was healthy before... before the decision of the Ministry of Health. There is no reason why suddenly he would have been very ill.
Suddenly stopped his medication.
Yeah. So seeing people, obviously people can be ill and can die, but seeing people that because the decision of other people mm-hmm. Can die is something that I cannot bear. I will go on fighting for that or against that.
Especially in this country that you came to live in.
Yeah, because I really thought, and I still somewhere have in my mind the feeling that Israel can be a little bit different, I'm Zionist. Maybe not the way and the definition that many will use.
It may have developed for yourself over the 30 years.
I believe that there is a potential in Israel to make some very, very good things, and some very, very good things are happening. But as usual, you can, you know, when you have such strengths, you can use them for good or for bad things. And unfortunately, during the last period of time, I'm seeing a lot of darkness in this country. But then around me, there are good people, and I'm hopeful that something can happen.
Hatikva.
Hopefully, yeah. Yeah, that's my tikva, and that's why I'm here.
Patrick Levy, thank you very much.
Welcome. Bye, Washington.
So I leave Patrick's house with a familiar feeling of despair and hope struggling with each other. There are amazing people in this country doing amazing things in the face of amazing obstacles. Now, to face natural obstacles is one thing, but to face human institutional obstacles, institutions that one believes in and fights for most of the time, that can tear you apart sometimes. I mean, look, the whole Western world is dealing with a global refugee crisis, and there are many countries who are not yet emerging with a great deal of credit. And the expectation of a small country like Israel, with limited space, limited land, limited resources, and a demographic paranoia, the expectation for Israel to be the world's angels is perhaps too much to expect. But there's a teaching I often return to about Shammai and Hillel. Two of our people's greatest rabbis and leaders were very different types. Shammai was incredibly strict, and Hillel overwhelmingly compassionate. They were both of them cultural heroes, but the question arises, who should we try to emulate? And the answer that the sages give us is that we should always try to emulate Hillel, the generous one, and not try to emulate Shammai, the strict one. Apparently because it's always better to try and fail at being superhumanly compassionate like Hillel. You might not end up being wise, but at least you'll be kind. But if you try and fail to be like the stickler Shammai, you'll just end up being perhaps thoughtlessly cruel. I guess none of us can hope to reach the heights of Hillel, but I know I'm buoyed up by folks like Patrick Levy, who are, well, they're giving it a go. And thank you for listening. This podcast, part of the Imagine Israel Initiative, is brought to you by the Jewish Federation of Greater Washington and hosted and produced by me, Robbie Greengrass of Macomb. You can find us on shalomdc.org/ Imagine Israel Podcast.